Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. You may know that half or more of all new doctors in the U.S. are women. For more than a decade, females have achieved parity in medical school admission numbers. However, sadly, that doesn't imply there's gender parity in the profession of medicine, where old habits and sexism die hard. My guest today, writer Suzanne Coven, reflected on her journey to medicine when, along with new hospital interns, she wrote a letter to her younger self, giving herself permission to be herself and understand the imposter feelings that sometimes come along with being a woman in medicine and a humanities major to boot. The letter was published as an essay in the New England Journal of Medicine, where, as the saying goes, it went viral. Coven expanded the letter into a series of essays, beautifully weaved together as a new memoir called Letter to a Young Female Physician, which is just out from Norton. Suzanne Coven is a primary care physician and the inaugural writer-in-residence at Massachusetts General Hospital, where she's also on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. She'll be appearing via Zoom in Tulsa as part of her book tour through Magic City Books this coming Thursday, May 13th from 7 to 8 p.m. Registration is free and online through Magic City Books. Suzanne Coven, author of Letter to a Young Female Physician, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Suzanne Coven, welcome back to Medical Monday. Let's start just by talking about the title of your book, Letter to a Young Female Physician, which opens the book. Tell us about the letter and what led you to write it.
Well, thanks for having me, John. The letter came out of really a very tiny moment. I was sitting at an orientation exercise for interns at my hospital in June of 2016. And one of the activities for the interns was to write a letter to their future selves. And the letters were collected and sealed, and they were to be opened 6 months later, when presumably the interns would see how far they've come. And as I was watching it, I just found myself very moved. And I started wondering, well, if I wrote a letter to my former self as an intern exactly 30 years earlier, what would I say? So I wrote a letter to myself, and the letter became the essay in the New England Journal of Medicine. And that essay now has become a book. I wish I could tell you all of this was well planned from that one moment in June of 2016, but that would absolutely not be true.
Well, it certainly has, I guess, taken on a life of its own. And the letter's a little too long to read on the air, but I suppose at readings you will be asked to do that, I have little doubt, or at least portions of the letter. But sure. I guess one of the themes I would just love to have you explore, which seems to be a big part of the letter, is this idea of imposter syndrome. And I guess I'm wondering if you could just share what that is for, you know, our listeners that may not know or recognize it, and then maybe how you felt it or perhaps fear that young female physicians may encounter that.
Absolutely. Well, imposter syndrome is a term I didn't hear until I had actually had it for many decades. It was actually first described by a couple of psychologists at Georgia State back in 1978, which was 4 years before I started medical school. But I didn't hear the term imposter phenomenon or imposter syndrome until many years later. But clearly I had it. And I think a lot of girls and women have it, and as well as people of color, LGBTQ people, anybody who sort of gets the message that they're just not quite up to snuff in some way, in large or small ways. And actually, after I published the first essay, I should say, I found out that there are a lot of men who have this and a lot of people who, you know, who haven't been exposed to any sort of bias or prejudice or much have it. And basically what it is this nagging feeling you have that whatever you achieve must be through some sort of luck or fluke, that it can't be that you've actually earned your spot at the school, your position at work, your promotion, and that you're always in danger of being found out. For me, this became very acute when I arrived at medical school, having studied English literature in college, my science background wasn't quite equal to some of my classmates who had majored in science in college. And, you know, the body of knowledge you need to master in medical school, as you know, is really large. And it's large for everybody, and it's impossible to master it completely. So the appropriate response to being faced with this monumental task is to say, you know, it's really hard, and I'm going to do my best, and I'm going to study really, you know, hard. And it's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be okay, and I'm going to do my best. Instead, my response was to feel, you know, I'm uniquely inadequate. I'm going to get found out. I don't really belong here. In fact, a friend of mine in medical school and I, we called ourselves the asterisks, as in, yes, we got into medical school, asterisk, but there probably weren't that many applicants that year. You know, there always had to be, you know, always had to be sort of a qualifier. And so this is something that I only realized years and years later was a very kind of insidiously destructive feeling, and something that actually at times made me make bad choices, made me sort of, you know, make professional choices that I might not have made simply because I was trying to prove that I was okay, that I belonged. But the other thing I should say about imposter syndrome is that, you know, you think, well, if I just get into that school or get that promotion, then I won't feel this way anymore. But it's the opposite. Achievement throws gas on the fire of imposter syndrome. The higher you climb, the more you feel like a fraud, which is why people like Serena Williams and Sonia Sotomayor and Tom Hanks and Lady Gaga have actually spoken publicly about being imposters. So, I mean, if Serena Williams is an imposter, you really have to ask yourself, you know, what is the real thing? And I think that's something that we should ask ourselves. If we're, you know, women in medicine, for example, and we're imposters, what does it mean not to be an imposter? Does it mean that we're perfect? Well, that's not achievable. So anyway, I wrote this letter, and I really I realized that what had moved me when I was sitting at that conference table watching these young doctors write these letters, is that I wanted to spare them the years of self-castigation. And so I wrote the letter, and the response I got was in some ways very gratifying in that people seemed to really relate to it, but in some ways was very alarming because I felt, you know, gee, 30 years later, why should young women, and men for that matter, still be feeling this way?
Tell us a little bit about the response. I mean, emails, calls, social media kinds of things. Did you hear from people all over the world?
Yes, it was beyond my wildest dreams. When I first published this piece, I thought, well, you know, it's got a pretty narrow focus. Letter to a Young Female Physician was the title of the original essay, as well as the book now. And I thought, you know, I'll probably get a few emails from young female physicians and maybe a few polite congratulatory notes from, you know, my colleagues who know me. But the response was overwhelming. I mean, I just got dozens and dozens and dozens of emails, social media, private messages, tweets, and so forth. And they weren't just from young women, weren't just from women, and weren't just from physicians. This got picked up by the lay press. It was picked up by Bloomberg News and Time and Fortune as a workplace phenomenon, not specifically a young female physician phenomenon.
Yeah, and you've raised the question, I mean, if so many people are feeling some sense of being an imposter, and more than half of the profession, of the medical profession nowadays, is women, right? What does that really say? And I guess, not to really fast forward or anything, but was there a time at which you stopped feeling like an imposter? Or, I guess elements of it persist to this day.
Mm-hmm. No, I would say, honestly, I don't feel that way anymore. I don't feel like an imposter anymore. I hesitate to tell you how long it took me to get there because I don't want to be discouraging to my younger colleagues. But honestly, it wasn't until I was in my 50s. And I think what ultimately cured me of it was just kind of the messy work of life, marriage and raising kids, practicing medicine, and writing actually helped me a lot. These are all endeavors where you go day to day and you make mistakes and you fumble and you pick yourself up again and you're never perfect. You're never going to be perfect. And yet you're still not an imposter. And I think it was writing, and particularly writing about my own feelings of fraudulence, that ultimately cured me of it.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Suzanne Coven, who is a primary care physician and the inaugural writer in residence at Massachusetts General Hospital. She's also on the faculty at Harvard Medical School. She's author of the brand new book, Letter to a Young Female Physician, Notes from a Medical Life. And Dr. Coven will be appearing in Tulsa on a Zoom book talk coming up May 13th. From 7 to 8 p.m., and that's through Magic City Books, and that's free and open to the public. You can register online. And we're talking about the original letter that became the motif of the book and a little bit about the imposter syndrome that you, Suzanne Coven, Dr. Coven, and others feel. And I would just echo, you highlighted that there are actually many men that feel that way, and I would put myself in that category. Many times I felt that way, both about being a doctor and many other things. But I wanted to, the book is beautiful. I just want to say I devoured it. It's really readable. It's written as a, I would say, short chapters. Each one reads like an essay. There's a chronology to it. It's basically about your journey through medicine, but it's beautifully rendered with stories of your family. And I wanted to focus on your parents because you write lovingly about both of them. So let's start with your father, who was a doctor, whose footsteps you sort of followed in, but didn't exactly. Tell us about your father and what he did and kind of what you learned from him.
Well, my father was a really fascinating and wonderful man, and to me, perhaps a little bit mysterious. He had been a war hero in World War II, was in the medical corps, and then came home and established a practice in his hometown of Brooklyn, New York, of orthopedic surgery. Except that he, even though he worked very long hours, he never talked about his work at home. The only evidence I ever saw of him being a doctor when I was a child was that his shoes were always spattered with plaster dust from putting casts on, since he was an orthopedic surgeon, and the fact that the phone would often ring late at night when, in those pre-pager days, an answering service would call. And he was an extremely cultured and intelligent man. His hobbies were collecting rare books. He was a self-taught scholar of the novels of James Joyce. He was quite an accomplished painter, but he was extremely quiet, self-contained, perhaps a little shy, and he never once encouraged me to be a doctor, nor did he discourage me. What he did allow me to do was follow him into his office and into the hospital with him. And that's not something he initiated. That's something I wanted to do as even when I was a child and a young teenager. And that made a very, very big impression on me. However, I did not particularly like math and science. I didn't excel in those subjects. And I assumed that, you know, this medicine thing wasn't for me. for two reasons. One, I wasn't a math and science person, and also because I was a girl. And in my little world that I grew up in, the husbands were doctors and the wives were housewives.
And yet you thought very seriously, as you pointed out, as an English major in your college days, you gave serious thought to becoming a journalist, but in the end decided to pursue medicine. So what went on there?
Well, I was a late bloomer. I didn't really make the decision to go to medical school until after I'd graduated from college and after I had my first job as an assistant editor at a magazine just for a few months before I returned to the classroom to take the required courses. I think after, you know, when you're in school, you, particularly in college, you think of life as being led semester to semester. And then you get out of college or out of high school and you realize that your life is lived year to year and decade to decade. And that if you're not doing what you really want to do, if you have the luxury to do what you really want to do, then, you know, you really ought to start thinking about doing what you want to do because you don't live forever, which is something you don't think about a lot when you're really young. And so I got out of college. I had this first job, which was sort of boring and miserable. And I just realized that, you know, maybe I would love being a doctor and maybe I could hold my nose and take organic chemistry and maybe I could actually do that. And in fact, it wasn't really all that bad.
Wasn't that bad, huh? Okay.
And I actually did have to hold my nose because the lab smelled terrible.
Right. Among many
Literally.
Other affronts. Yes. I want to shift gears and talk a little bit about your mother because there your roles as daughter and doctor kind of converged. And you had some regrets, I think, or at least guilt, I should say, maybe not regrets, about her medical care. And now you were in Boston and working, and as you point out, a parent and a spouse and a doctor. And your mom at that point was living in Florida where her health had sort of taken a turn for the worse. And briefly share with us, if you can, kind of what transpired in her case.
Right. My mom, like my dad, was really a wonderful, remarkable person, a very different kind of person. She was quite gregarious, quite social, and she did a pretty remarkable thing, maybe not by today's standards, but then it really was. When she was 43 years old in 1970, she applied to law school, having been a housewife all those years. And so the thing was that I think it's said that couples, married couples, tend to polarize. You know, they take on different roles. In my parents' case, my father was 10 years older than my mother, and he tended to be in poor health a lot. My mother was more vigorous. She was younger, and she was, you know, her role was the healthy one and the caregiver. And then when he died, it was thought that she was in her late 70s, she would sort of go on and have another act. But it was not meant to be. She developed a cancer, which required treatment. And during that treatment, which I insisted she have in Boston, she was complaining of fatigue and cough and shortness of breath. And she would get short of breath, and this would make her anxious. And I was having a lot of trouble sorting it out. To be fair, her doctors were also having trouble sorting it out. And then months and months of symptoms came to a head one day when she arrived in the emergency room of my own hospital having a massive heart attack. And I felt just terrible about this. I mean, here I am, a veteran clinician. Most of my patients are women. So essentially, I'm a practitioner of women's health. I'm supposed to be very astute about the ways women's heart disease looks different than men's heart disease. And here, my mother was having a myocardial infarction under my very nose. And she never recovered from that. This was a source of tremendous guilt for me, even though my colleagues assured me that, you know, there was nothing different I could have done, and that she was my mother. She wasn't my patient. I was told that by my colleagues again and again, and it was true. And yet, the fact is that, as I say in the book, if someone you love suffers and you can't prevent it, you feel badly and guilty, even if that's irrational. And if you're a doctor or a nurse, if you're someone who has medical training and someone you love suffers medically, that guilt is compounded. Now, my mother never saw it that way. She never once said to me, you know, why didn't you realize I was going to have a heart attack? That never would have occurred to her to say something like that in a million years. She saw me as her daughter, the doctor, in some ways that almost made it more painful because I felt, and perhaps we're getting back to imposter syndrome here, I felt that I had not lived up to her expectations, even if she didn't feel that way.
Yeah, there's so much packed in there, but I would totally agree with your colleagues who say that, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. I mean, it's hard enough to make a diagnosis in someone who you have a professional relationship with. It's a whole other thing when it's your family member who leans on you, and there's all kinds of sort of ethical questions and boundaries and all kinds of, you know, I would say almost impaired judgment that goes into it when it's our own loved
right.
ones that come to us with their medical complaints. I mean, it's why we
right.
say, you know, get a real doctor, you know, call your
yeah,
doctor.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, she had several real doctors in multiple locations. But, you know, still the story wasn't being put together. And, you know, I say the word story, and it reminds me to make this point, which is that, as I say in the book, the lack of objectivity I had about my mother's illness wasn't so much emotional. It wasn't like I loved her too much to believe that she had a bad heart, or, you know, I had, you know, deep hostile feelings toward her and I wished her ill. No, it was neither of those. It was that I was too close to the story that she told herself. And the story she told herself was that she had been a caregiver for many years, and now she was a widow, and she was going to be active and healthy and live a vibrant rest of her life. And I was on board with that story. So a few months after my dad died, when she kept calling me and telling me how tired she was, I would say, well, of course you're tired. You know, you've been through a lot. And unfortunately, I only found out later that her fatigue was not a broken heart in the metaphorical sense. It was that she had heart disease.
Yeah. Let me, I'm going to reintroduce you here. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Dr. Suzanne Coven, author of the beautiful new book, Letter to a Young Female Physician. Suzanne Coven is a primary care physician practicing in Boston. She's the inaugural writer in residence at Massachusetts General Hospital, where she also serves on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. She's going to be appearing with Magic City Books this coming Thursday, May 13th at 7 p.m. And you can register for that free and online. It's a Zoom, like many of all of the book events have been, and we'll continue this conversation there. So if you're interested in what you're hearing, we'll have a chance to unpack more, and you'll have a chance to ask Dr. Coven questions. Suzanne, I want to pivot for a second, and in the introduction there, I mentioned that you're the writer-in-residence, inaugural writer-in-residence at Massachusetts General Hospital, and, you know, that title sounds like words we understand, but I'm not sure that the radio audience can fully appreciate how special and unique that is. Tell us what that role entails for you and how it came about.
Well, your audience is in very good company because it's a really unique role, and it definitely takes some explaining. There are writers in residence in hospitals. They are usually not physicians. They're usually writers who are doing therapeutic writing with patients, sometimes with staff. My role, which I developed myself with the support of my hospital, is entirely centered on staff. I coach staff who are interested in writing, and there are a lot of them. And these are clinical and non-clinical hospital workers. I run literary events at the hospital, like our annual celebration of National Poetry Month we just had in April. And the core of what I do, though, is facilitating reading and writing workshops. And I talk a little bit about that in the book, how reading and writing, which starting in about my 40s, was a sort of extracurricular part of my life, came closer and closer to the center of my professional life in the hospital. And now it's not unusual at all for me to, well, of course, now we're doing it on Zoom, for me to meet with a group of doctors and nurses, chaplains, therapists, and other hospital workers and talk about poems and memoirs, plays, and novels. And it's just a joyous, wonderful experience for me and I hope for them.
The name of the book is Letter to a Young Female Physician, Notes from a Medical Life. And it's by our guest today, Dr. Suzanne Coven, who is a primary care physician and the inaugural writer-in-residence at Massachusetts General Hospital, where she serves on the faculty at Harvard Medical School. She'll be appearing this week, Thursday, May 13th at 7 p.m. through Magic City Books, and you can sign up for that free and online at magiccitybooks.com. Suzanne Coven, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, John. It's been a real treat.
Congratulations on the book, and I hope it does really well. It's great.
Thanks so much.
Suzanne Coven is a primary care physician and the inaugural writer-in-residence at Massachusetts General Hospital, where she's on the faculty at Harvard Medical School. Her new book is Letter to a Young Female Physician, Notes from a Medical Life. She'll be appearing in Tulsa through Magic City Books this Thursday, May 13th. You can register online for free at magiccitybooks.com. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Shun with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.